Hello, welcome to Roots Runners Rhizomes, Radical Health and Healing from the Underground. I'm Sarah Faulkner.
And I'm Lauren Jambroni.
And we have Rob Bouillon on the line with us today. Hey, Rob, how's it going?
Good morning. How are you both doing?
We're good. And we're very feeling the theme of the show today, which is in part navigating the unexpected, especially yes. unexpected difficulties. And we have Rob here today on the show for part of the show. He's going to be giving us a report back of some recovery work that he did with his family.
In Texas.
And so we'll let him talk a little bit about that. And then he's going to be giving sort of some thoughts about general preparedness. And as a Hudson resident, he can also speak to maybe some of the infrastructure and things here in our community that maybe would be good for us to know about. So yeah. Without further ado, welcome, Rob. Tell us what's going on.
Sure. I appreciate you both having me on the show today. So I spent a little over a week in Port Aransas, Texas, which is a coastal island. It's part of the barrier islands of Texas that hug the Intercoastal Canal. And this island happens to be east of Corpus Christi, which is a fairly well-known South Texas town. And my dad's currently the mayor there. He was elected back in May. It'll be 2 years ago this coming May.
Wow.
Our family was one of the four. So I think I've spoken in previous radio shows that, you know, my mom's family's from Germantown. So I have kind of this, you know, I was attracted back to the Hudson Valley and to Hudson because of my mother's side of the family. And I've not spoken a lot about my dad's side of the family.
But, right, yeah.
My dad's side of the family founded, we were one of the four founding families of Port Aransas. It was, it's the northernmost tip of Padre Island. People may recognize Padre Island as where, you know, everybody in Oklahoma, Kansas, and Missouri go for in the month of March and mm-hmm. drink until they pass out on the beach, AKA spring break. Port Aransas actually is one of the largest. It's a town of about 4,000 people. It's very similar to Hudson, and I'll talk about that a little bit. It's quite interesting. But they have two industries. They have the fishing industry, which is kind of their what they would have been, you know, if they had manufacturing. But it's their industry was, you know, it was built on the town was built on fishing and tarpon fishing and things like that. Mm. And then they also have tourism. And this town of 4,000 swells to over a quarter of a million for the month of March.
Spring breakers
revel and cause havoc, as
that's
my father likes to say.
People.
It's gone a little overboard. It's gone from fun to like the Islanders kind of, you know, kind of lock up their doors and.
Well, that's a huge increase.
So 4,000 people to 250,000 people
in 1 month.
Yeah, so overnight. It's crazy. So it's a very challenging thing. That was my dad's kind of biggest concern when becoming mayor. He's like, you know, this, you know, because the mayor doesn't the position doesn't pay any money. It's an elected position, and it's really kind of a retiree position. So that was kind of his biggest concern. And, you know, how he was going to handle it. And he did a good job last year. He has, you know, San Antonio and Houston and the state police ended up having to drop police out of helicopters onto the beaches in order to take care of some riot control and things like that. But that's just kind of what you have. Like, you know, they've been islanders since the late 1800s, immigrants from Eastern Europe and like around Kosovo and Montenegro. My family's actually, my dad's family's from Montenegro originally. Mm. But that all changed on August 25th of this year when Harvey decided to set his sights on ground zero of Port Aransas. And
gosh, wow.
Spring break's just is nothing compared to what they're going through right now.
Right.
It's interesting. Port Aransas has weathered some pretty bad storms in the 70s. They, you know, people growing up, my grandmother would talk about surviving Carla and surviving Cecile. And and Fern and these really just this kind of historic, these names that you would just know growing up. And when you actually met somebody that had that name, you just kind of were scared of them just because they talked to them. You knew them as a hurricane before a person, right? And, you know, Harvey did something that none of these other storms that were pretty devastating storms did. It pretty much devastated Port Aransas. 75% of all building structures, both commercial and residential, had either been severely damaged or permanently destroyed.
Wow.
The marina has sinkholes and has fallen into the water. The docks are all gone. The fishing piers are, for the most part, all gone. There's, you know, many of the restaurants are gone. All the bait shacks on the causeway going into the island are gone. They lost their police station, their jail, their courthouse, their library, the school library, most of the DPW trucks, most of the fire trucks, pretty much all services they've lost. The Coast Guard station's gone. University of Texas Marine Research Center's gone. A&M was severely damaged. So, you know, my dad's 73. He's retired. He worked for a large insurance company for many years. And he and my stepmom, when they decided to kind of, you know, retire in Port Aransas, they, you know, he had a fishing guide business that he ran, and we've had a trailer park in our family for about 80 years, which is a plot of land. And my stepmother's the works for the school district, and all of that's kind of gone right now. You know, we've lost the trailer park. My dad's fishing guide business is pretty much gone, and he's just working to kind of try to figure out how to rebuild.
Wow. And I guess that the decision to rebuild has definitely been made, or is that even up for grabs?
So to kind of get the flavor, Port Aransas, you know, the islanders, the old families that have lived there for numerous years, they will persevere, and they are going to rebuild. Like, there's no question about whether or not they're going to rebuild. It's how are they going to rebuild, and how are they going to do it in a safe and thoughtful way, while also balancing, you know, the needs. You know, when you lose all of the businesses and things, and you don't have the influx of tourism, you don't have jobs. So we have people who are, you know, we have people who are homeless down there. In, you know, 2017, we have lots of people who are homeless. We have people who can't make a living. We have, you know, kids who are having trouble coming back into the school district because they have no place to live. And the federal government just isn't really there.
Wow. So let's back up a little. And if you could talk about your own personal experience living here in Hudson and kind of hearing about the approach of the hurricane. You know, many of us in the community have friends or family somewhere in one of the paths of one of these different storms. I just this week, personally, my former home in County Cork, Ireland, had its first onslaught of a hurricane. There's no word for hurricane in the native Irish Gaelic language. That's a real anomaly. So, you know, when we have folks here with friends and family in Puerto Rico, also super devastated. So, for example, so maybe if you could talk a little bit about what your experience was, how you made the decision to then go yourself and help your dad, and how it was for you sort of listening to the news and you know, when did he, how did folks navigate all that?
Sure. So, you know, our news cycles are so short anymore. It's, you know, it's been 9 weeks, I think, since the hurricane hit, and people probably have forgotten that, you know, many people have forgotten that the hurricane even hit Texas at this point, because we have so many other things going on in the world and in this country that are so devastating.
Right.
But, you know, kind of following my dad and trying to figure out the best the best approach that I could help them. You know, I can help them from far away. You know, my company is in insurance, as you know, and we've been posting a lot of free services on our website for folks in all of the devastated areas for mental health assistance at no cost and teledoc assistance to be able to speak to a doctor because many people don't have access to medical care.
Mm.
But, you know, I had been speaking to my stepmom and my dad, and, you know, it came to a point that they just, there's just a desperation that they just didn't feel that they could, you know, I just knew at that moment, I was like, you know, I'm just going to go down next week. I'm going to help you finish filling out all of your claim forms because they have, you have to fill out your wind insurance and flood insurance and homeowners insurance. All the policies are separate and each excludes the other. And,
jeez, yeah.
And we had, you know, some other property pieces. You know, we had a couple of other workshops and stuff that had to get cleaned out that my dad just couldn't kind of really do himself because it was a lot of the antique tools and things of his father and grandfather and thing like that. So I went down there and expecting to see some devastation and to see, you know, what they've been speaking of. I can't tell you driving into Port Aransas, because Port Aransas is two ways to get in there. You can either go over a ferry that goes across the international ship channel, and it's usually teeming with dolphin and seagulls, and it's just absolutely gorgeous. And Port Aransas is the shining town just at the tip of this island. Or you can go across Island Road, is what they call it, out of Corpus. So we did that. And as we started to go in, and you're seeing the resorts and the snowbird trailer parks and things like that, and everything is kind of wiped out, and there's just this seagrass everywhere. And as soon as you get to like the entrance of Port Aransas proper, there's probably a 2 8-story trash piles. And I said to my dad, I mean, along with debris on the roads and everything else. And I said to my dad, I asked my dad, you know, what is that? He said, well, son, that's about a quarter of our residents' houses and belongings, because that's everything's gone. So they're literally just kind of wiping the island clean of all of this stuff and putting it in these huge trash piles.
Oh, my goodness.
And it just, it was so unbelievably overwhelming, and just, it just kind of like, I felt gutted. Like, I really never understood what that word meant or right. that phrase meant. And I literally felt gutted. And then driving around the island, every single road just was filled and heaped with trash and people's houses that were bulldozed. And it just, and I couldn't even recognize. I mean, I've been on the island on and off for 47 years, and I couldn't even recognize neighborhoods or figure out where, what corner I was standing on.
Right.
My grandmother's house
wow.
was in piles, and the trailer park was devastated, and my dad's house had been, had gotten flooded through. So it was just absolutely unbelievable. And I thought to myself, I don't know where to start. And they've been living this for 8 weeks, and they're smiling and just happy to be alive.
Mm. Wow. Wow.
So, you know, so my biggest thing was like, what am I going to do? So when, you know, we wanted to make sure we finished kind of cleaning up and cleaning out all of the structures that had to be bulldozed, and then working on all the insurance claims and things like that, which is really important to have done. And then just kind of be their support. I helped my dad with putting a presentation together for the governor in order for them to get some additional funding, because FEMA wasn't coming through on funding. So, you know, pretty much anything and everything I could do to kind of help them make it just a little bit better, I did. Just, you know, when you're in that much shock and that overwhelmed, you don't know what you don't know, and you don't know what you do know anymore.
Right.
You know, trying to navigate claims and how to get prescriptions to people on the island when you lose your one pharmacy and your one grocery store, and the next one is 18 miles away, and it's a town much like Hudson. Half the residents don't have cars.
Wow. Wow. Amazing. So how long were you there?
A little over a week.
Mm-hmm. And what kinds of things did you think about relating Port Aransas to Hudson, for example, you know, population size similar, economy sort of similarly to main sources of income, including tourism. Were you thinking thoughts about sort of the recovery at that point?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I've speaking to my dad over the last year, and with my run for alderman in the first ward, he and I have spoken a lot about like some of the challenges that Port Aransas has had and that he has had. And it's very interesting, just in general, prior to this trip, I can insert either town and there's economic development. There is protection of the coastal, the coastline.
Mm-hmm.
There's affordable housing. There's short-term rentals. There's transportation. There's further education, and there's job training. Which town am I talking about?
Mm.
Both of them.
Right.
You know, they have these same things and these same challenges. And after kind of spending the week there, I really thought, you know, all of those things are super important. You know, all of the committees we have are important. All of the things that are going on with the affordable housing group and the river keepers and everybody that are, you know, working together to kind of balance all of that. That's all needed, because that's kind of all the future and what we need to, you know, the ultimate goal of a city is to have the children come back and raise their children in your town. That's kind of the success barometer of a city, right? They're coming back and they want to kind of relive or give that back to their children.
Mm-hmm.
But what I don't think that small cities and small towns like ours probably are very good at is, what if we are faced with a natural disaster? What is our business continuity plan? What if we lose our police station and our courthouse and our fire trucks and our DPW and we have no electricity, or we have a huge, you know, financial economic downturn and we lose, you know, all of our tourism, or we have flooding, you know, what do we do? And, you know, it's interesting in Port Aransas, with Port Aransas, they just relied on each other. It's kind of neighbor helping neighbor, and it's not that us versus them. Prior to the hurricane, it was all the, you know, the longtime islanders and then the city folks from San Antonio and Houston trying to change the old island ways. Does that sound familiar? I mean, it's the same story everywhere, but that's all gone. And it took a catastrophe and a disaster to realize that whether you were born there or whether you moved there 50 years ago or whether you're there for 2 years, they all give something back to the community, and they all need to rely on each other, and they all need to, you know, find a common ground to get along, because if you don't have that, what do we have?
Right. Yeah, I was curious, Rob, about, because this will kind of inform the rest of our show when you have to cut out, but I was curious about what maybe like an example or something of resilience efforts you saw while you were down there that really struck you.
And anything that you found for yourself, an act of self-care or focusing, or just how you kind of made it through.
Absolutely. You know, one of the interesting things are, you know, there were a couple of people that there is, for whatever reason, their house was, they're the only house standing on a block. Like, it's, you know, hurricanes and fires and things like that. They have minds of their own.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I know one, a friend of mine, actually, a friend of the family, who her house is standing. She had electricity. She had a generator.
Oh my goodness,
for all the volunteers, she would go around and collect their clothes and wash all of their clothes every day so that they had clean clothes to volunteer in. And other people that had gas would cook and bring food to the volunteers. And the school students, when they were displaced after they started school, they would come and in groups and help to clean out these houses. And so it was really, you know, what can you do, not what can't you do?
Sure.
You know, that was the biggest thing. And for me, you know, and being in the insurance industry, you know, I think I say this a lot, and I say it kind of in jest, because I sometimes annoy people by it, but I'm in the business to ensure risk. You know, I want to make sure that if, you know, whatever situation occurs, that you have the least financial responsibility possible in order to get that. And one of the things that I saw this year, which I don't think that you really can say a lot in this world today, is, you know, the insurance companies, both on the property and casualty and the health insurance side, kind of stepped up during these natural disasters when the federal government really didn't. So, you know, if you go to our WeInsureRisk.com website, neither link to our property and casualty or our group side of the house, you'll see resources for free counseling, unlimited free counseling. You can call any of the insurance companies, say that you're a victim of the fires in Northern California, the hurricanes in Texas, Florida, or Puerto Rico, and you can have access to speak to a counselor any time of the day or night, as many sessions as you want, because, you know, it's really important that we, you know, identify and address the, you know, the hurt and the pain that you can't necessarily see.
Sure, absolutely.
And they also are doing free telemedicine. So if you don't have access to your primary care physician for some reason and you're feeling sick and, you know, in these areas, you know, staph infections and tetanus and everything else, you know, you want to be careful of, you have access to emergency room doctors 24 hours a day that will call in prescriptions. And some of the insurance companies are, you know, giving the prescriptions away at cost and things like that. So there are resources out there, and, you know, it's important that people kind of tap into those resources and, you know, use them and in order to help kind of supplement and kind of re-energize themselves to kind of fight the hard fight, because Puerto Aransas, it's going to be about 5 or 6 years before it's back to where it was. And Puerto Rico, you know, is even worse. And we have Florida and we have all these areas. We really, you know, we really need to kind of identify that governing is really a neighborly thing, and it crosses parties, and it's about supporting and you know, being there for your neighbor.
Mm. Yeah.
Wow.
Did you have any other resources, or do you want to repeat that website again too, that you wanted to share with folks?
Sure. If you go to We Insure Risk, so WeInsureRisk.com. That will link to our STL brokerage, which is our property and casualty website that has tips on how to file insurance claims for your, you know, homeowners insurance and contents. And then on the Group Health Solutions site, that will link to various national insurance companies like Aetna and Cigna and the Blues in each of the states that are offering free mental health and telemedicine services to those that are affected in any of the tragedies across the country right now.
Wow.
Thank you.
Thank you. I know we're getting down to the time that you need to take your leave of us. Anything else you want to say today, Rob?
I really appreciate you having me on the phone today. I think that this trip to Texas has kind of changed my, kind of put things in perspective as to what's really important in, you know, the definition of a need and a want. And, you know, as I move into my role after the general election as an alderman for the first ward, I'm really going to, you know, put that perspective and put the rubber to the road and really work to figure out a way that, you know, at the end of the day, that should Hudson ever have a situation come up, that, you know, we as a community can really band together and figure out ways to do it now, not when the tragedy or situation's already occurred.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Rob. Thanks for being on the show today.
All right. Thank you both. I really appreciate it.
Have a great day. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Wow. Okay. I got a little teary and emotional.
Did I do that right?
I think
just
so.
A little technical
we
question.
Got it.
Yeah, because you know what? The theme of today's show is kind of...
Yeah.
Dealing with the unexpected, mm-hmm. or things that you find yourself doing and you're maybe you don't feel equipped or like you mm-hmm. have information needed to do the mm-hmm. best right thing, or at least that's the sensation we have sometimes, because mm-hmm. of course sometimes there actually is no information or experience
right.
in the what you're navigating, right? That's the nature of catastrophe, disaster, but also, you know, small scale or large scale, right? Is that a hurricane, or is that like you lose your job, or mm-hmm. you maybe you live with a domestic partner and something happens and things are radically different overnight. Mm-hmm. Illness, what else, right?
Car accidents,
right?
And also, too, we're kind of in this bubble here in the valley where, you know, not that there's not things happening in our individual and collective lives here, but, you know, there's raging fires and floods and storms happening all across our country and
in the world. And those of anyone who has Facebook mm-hmm. people on like the Facebook feed, right? The past few months mm-hmm. has been pretty intense with, mm-hmm. you know, whole sections of the planet burning.
Right.
I certainly have friends and family who've been affected by that. And then storms, earthquakes.
Right.
Political unrest.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Climate change.
Yeah.
Is real.
Yeah.
Science is real.
Yeah. Yeah. And
just in case anyone is still wondering.
But back to your point. Yeah, it's true. In the Hudson Valley, our weather's pretty mild compared to some of what we're seeing in the news, right?
Yeah.
You know, like, okay, snow removal can seem like a catastrophe in Hudson sometimes on the Hudson Community Board, but actually no lives were lost that I know of.
Oh, well, I like the opportunity to talk about, you know, the word resilience and what that means and kind of weathering the storm, mm-hmm. so to say, in terms of personal navigation of emotional and physical needs. And it was interesting to hear Rob talk about these websites and ways to access help on a larger scale. Because, if you're, like, in the thick of it, where do you even begin? And filling out an insurance form when you, it's kind of like, wait, that's what you do first? You know, I can only imagine it being super confusing to know where to even start. And then, like we were just saying, folks like us here who are not experiencing something like that firsthand, but have all the secondary information coming in, or family or friends experiencing it firsthand, but not ourselves. You know, there's just there's ripple effect and trauma, and we have to take care of ourselves in order to hold all of this and make moves forward. So.
And also, before it gets lost in our discussion, to touch back on another thing Rob said, like, let's not wait until something happens to figure out. And also the fact that he was even able to note in the middle of a recovery effort, you know, people were banding together, and there's some kind of, this has been my experience, and I say this as a person who lived in New York City during the 9/11 World Trade Center collapse, mm-hmm. which also, you know, collapsed cell phone and power, mm-hmm. the grid was down mm-hmm. in New York City, and people didn't really know what was going on. And then the same thing happened a year later with a blackout, and I was there for both of those events. And what I found interesting, even at the time, of course, you know, it was really traumatic and devastating on a personal and emotional level. But one thing that did happen, as we were all trying to figure out together collectively, because when you're in a city there's a bunch of people were checking on each other. People were, you know, the subway wasn't running, and people were walking over to each other's houses. Mm-hmm. And, hey, are you okay? I was just, even people that maybe you didn't think you knew that well or wouldn't consider like a close friend. And it was one of those moments where I saw that people were experiencing something that they wish they could experience at other times without having to wait for something awful to happen.
Right.
You know, it doesn't have to be world-class catastrophe. It could be maybe you have the flu, mm-hmm. or maybe you just you need some extra help. And wouldn't it be great if we had a support system in place where folks would say, hey, I can help you with mm-hmm. that, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And so many things get in the way of that.
Right.
capitalism.
Yeah, that's a big one.
Right.
Isolation. I'm kind of big on the critique of social media at the moment in terms of sort of this, it's this medium through which we often feel like we're connecting with others or helping, like signing petitions and having conversations and stuff. But then, and it can, right? It's a medium, it's a format, but stuff is going on with the glowing screen, changing our sort of responses on an emotional, psychological, biological level. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm seeing a lot of folks that feel really stressed out.
Right.
And also, when you're staring at a screen, it's not like bringing someone some soup.
Yeah, and a lot of people have so much to say, and they think it's so incredibly important for everyone else to hear.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of like inflammation that happens.
Right, even with good intentions, like maybe folks have witnessed the Me Too campaign, right? Mm. So with sort of the revelations that this top movie producer, Harvey Weinstein, right? Mm. Also, the person occupying the American presidency right now, both have been, you know, folks have come forward revealing they've been sexually abused, sexually harassed by these people in positions of great power. And so some folks started this campaign, right, to hashtag Me Too in social media to bring awareness, like show how many folks were... have had a similar experience of being sexually harassed, sexually abused, sexually assaulted. And then, I don't know about you, but in my feed, I saw many other people and myself included feeling really triggered and traumatized by this whole thing, by witnessing sort of this, I don't know what, you know?
Yeah.
And I mean, I can certainly see that myself, the benefit of, stand up and be counted. I see that great intention there, right? And then I also really see... oh my goodness, this is just in my face.
Right,
and
it's horrible.
It's horrible.
And then also too, you know, I had a conversation with a male-identified and male-bodied friend who was really affected by that. Mm-hmm. And I could feel myself getting so tense and just thinking like, okay, I want to hear you out and, you know, I'm glad that you're so affected by this. And also like it took you this long, like,
right.
You know, sorry, pal, but like I've got, you know, 27 years, however long experience of this. And like, you're just waking up to it by a hashtag, like, thanks. And like next time all your bro friends are getting together and all of this, like, socially acceptable violence against women happening all the time, and women identified folks, female bodied folks, like, y'all gotta start checking each other and like stop being afraid to do that. Because while I am, you know, in part touched by the fact that this is bothering you so much, like, I'm tired. So I felt like a lot of like anger, and I didn't, you know, post anything about it because it just, I just didn't. It wasn't like something I wanted to do. And I just feel like a lot of anger. And that's where like the resiliency comes in again, because there are so many triggers and there are so many microaggressions and there are so many traumas in the world because of all the oppressions that we have to coexist with. And how do we do that? How do we keep weathering these storms? And
and also recognize that there's, I guess this is also for me a little bit of a story about emotional labor as part of processing trauma, right? And so this example that we're using, the Me Too campaign, so there were experiences like Lauren has just described, and then I've also experienced friends who are not female-bodied who have been sexually abused and assaulted, feeling shut out. Here we have like good intentions of trying to kind of make a campaign and instead, some people feeling connected by it and others feeling disconnected by it. So I guess, and there's emotional labor involved in sort of tending to that, right? And so in the fallout of any catastrophe, there's a lot of emotional labor involved really in you know, it's not just making soup and doing laundry and all this stuff that's, of course, very necessary. There's also a lot of... emotional labor and making sure folks are connecting, making sure everyone's needs are met without falling into scarcity mentality, which is kind of, again, where capitalism comes in, right? We think it's a zero-sum game. If you get, you know, if you get this ration, that means someone else doesn't get this ration. That's kind of this driving feeling that a lot of folks have in a situation that's not necessarily accurate, but it's something that really capitalism sort of invokes all the time to get us to work harder and buy more stuff and spend more money and hoard stuff, right? But then when a catastrophe happens, you know, in New York City, again, I've seen beautiful things happen, people sharing stuff and people looking out for each other. And I've also seen, like, even in just a snowstorm, you know, the price of batteries, bread, and milk, the bodega can go up. There's profiteers, right?
Right. Gas prices go up. So many things happen. There's always some kind of darkness.
Yeah. And, you know, even when it comes to preparing in advance of catastrophe, there's a real strong streak in our country of preppers, right?
Right.
You know, and that's the term for folks who they're thinking about, well, the word you can't even say on the air, when the hits the fan, right? And you know, having a go bag and there's some really awesome ideas there. I myself follow one Facebook group that has some tips for folks who consider themselves politically progressive who are interested in being prepared for disasters. There's also, folks with any kind of social justice background are also going to say the apocalypse has been happening for many people for a long time. And so we have really awesome models for collectively organized disaster response, right? You know, the classic street medics, right? Mm-hmm. What the history of street medics in the United States goes back to the 1960s, really. Folks setting up shop right here, right now, not, you know, necessarily even going to where there's been a hurricane, but in a situation like maybe most notably Charlottesville, right? Mm-hmm. After the... how do we want to frame what happened there?
Sure.
Rebellion. Yeah.
Standing Rock.
Yeah. You know, so.
So many.
So
places.
We have some awesome models that are collective, not hunker down in your bunker with your canned food and guns kind of way, which is, you know, again, the separating versus connecting mentality when it comes to preparing, right? And I know some folks, when you say disaster preparedness, they kind of get scared and think about, you know, the prepper mentality, right?
Right, right. What are some of, like, you know, just kind of curious about for you, like, whether it's lately or in the past, like, some of your favorite personal tools to kind of keep you resilient within the state of the world right now.
Within the state of the world. Yeah, that, because, yes. So I, you know, I could identify as a person with the diagnosis ADHD, right? And for me, what that means is I notice a lot of details and I get really interested in a lot of different things, and I often don't feel grounded, right? And when you don't feel grounded, it can be really hard to know which way to go and what to do next, and you know, maybe that's annoying enough in sort of everyday life, but in a disaster situation, you gotta really focus to move forward, right?
Sure.
You gotta prioritize in a good way. So I have been practicing, you know, down and dirty, easy to do focus strategies.
Great,
right?
Yeah.
And for me in my life, a really simple breathing, deep breathing exercise is kind of, you don't need any tools to do that. You just need to be alive and breathing.
Right.
So that's like really fundamental. So just sometimes it's super simple. I won't get into anything detailed, but you know, I just put one hand on my stomach and one hand on my chest. And so I can feel my breath expanding. in my body and slow it down and maybe count, you know, 3 or 7. That's like a great time tested one. But in general, I'd say for cultivating resilience in these times, I'm really focusing on the basics of eating the right food,
right,
moving my body regularly. For me, I like to, and keeping strong and flexible in a physical way, right? You know, and from that radiating outwards. So going to the gym and doing some yoga at night and eating food that makes me feel good and think clearly and trying to get enough sleep. That's not always so easy, but, you know, really looking at, okay, is it really necessary I do this or can I just go to sleep?
Sure, absolutely.
You know, because also sometimes the other thing, right, when you're in the middle of something, everything feels like an emergency and then everything's important to do and every, you know, right, that part of not being grounded.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
So sorting that out.
Yeah.
What are you doing for yourself these days?
Well, I definitely agree with like the returning to like the very basics. I've been making sure that there's food to in the fridge that I can cook when I feel kind of stressed with my own personal life and work and responsibilities and then the state of the world. I tend to not eat, and that's new, but it's been happening for a while. So I've been like, okay, right, like let me make sure I have food in the house, and then kind of limiting my commitments after work so that I can go home and cook. And I've been super focused on like, okay, is like the laundry done? Is my home clean? So that like where I go to bed and where I wake up doesn't feel chaotic. Also too, in like hectic times, I tend to like be a whirlwind in my living space. And then that just like further ignites the chaos. So that I've been doing and focusing on, which has been like essential to me feeling grounded. Also, because I love plants and plant medicine, I wanted to talk just a touch about dandelion flower essence. So flower essences are vibrational medicine. It's essentially you put dandelion flowers in a bowl of water and, you know, put them under the sun or under the moonlight, and the essence of that flower gets imprinted into the water. And then that water you can stabilize or preserve with brandy typically or vinegar. And then you take like 1 to 5 drops of that essence. And dandelion, you know, when we think about dandelion, it's the energy of that medicine is about community, is about connecting, is about resilience. No matter what, and no matter where dandelion grows, through the cracks of sidewalks, through abandoned parking lots, through lawns, despite how much Miracle will grow you buy at Agway, it just keeps coming for us. And it's this bright, beautiful, yellow, happy flower. And it's just inviting connection. So in times of like isolation, I find it really helpful. And there's also this like resiliency aspect of it, because it can kind of grow out of any crack. It's great when, I think it is great for emotional labor. So whether you're doing like health advocacy for a friend or a loved one, or emotional labor of any kind, holding space for people going through tragedy, it can kind of like, for me, it refills the well internally. So whether or not I take it or just have it near me or like know it's there, I find that super helpful. And then lastly, I just want to give a plug to baths. Baths have been like super essential. Just like sometimes I feel guilty about the amount of water that it takes to run a bath. And so I try to be a little like A, easy on myself about it, and B, like, you know, make it sacred, but a little Epsom salts and some hot water really kind of relaxes me in a way that pretty much nothing else does at this point. And I like to do it in the evening and then get right to bed. So for folks who might have trouble sleeping, falling asleep, staying asleep just because of stress or the state of the world, I really recommend a hot bath with some salts and Epsom salts in it. It just really relaxes the nervous system and promotes a super restful sleep for me in my experience. So just want to remind folks the power of the bathtub.
Nice. What are some ways, I'm going to talk a little bit about some ways that make it easy to ask for and receive and give concrete help.
Yeah.
Because, right, that's often, you know, sometimes even when you know that you need help, it's hard to even know how to begin to ask for it.
Right.
On my mind is something that some of us have recently participated in here in Hudson for a couple people in our community, and that's mealtrain.com, right? So like, you know, there are actually, I was kind of riffing on Facebook, and Facebook's another one too, actually. You can post and publicize, you know, that you need help informally, like on your status, right? And often people will come through, and it's a no pressure way. People it's maybe problematic because of algorithms. Maybe not everyone sees your requests, so you can also feel all sorry for yourself that no one's responding, and maybe they just didn't see it. That's good to remember. But and then there's apps like mealtrain.com where, say, someone has a baby or they've been sick, you can set it up for your friend, and it's a way that you can then publicize a scheduling, and people can schedule themselves to bring some food, bring a meal for people, and the people receiving the meal can post their requests or, you know, dietary, like the vegetarian or whatever. And then there's, it reduces the amount of emotional labor and organizing for everyone involved, because the app just holds this in space, sends you a reminder if you've signed up.
Yeah, so great. I love it.
Yeah. Are there any other things like that you can think of that folks can use?
Oh, like apps wise, gosh, I'm such a grandma. It's not quite.
Well, and GoFundMe. I mean, GoFundMe has kind of
You Caring, GoFundMe. There's all different kinds
Those are crowdsourced funding, but without, they're just, you can, again, post it on social media or email the link to folks, and that way folks can contribute money to a fund for someone who needs some help.
Sure. And also, just, you bring up a good point, like, allowing ourselves the bravery in asking for help, and knowing that that doesn't mean that you're an insufficient person who can't take care of biz the way you need to. It just means that sometimes we all need support, and it could be around something, you know, we don't have to compare our struggle with anyone else. Like, you're having a hard time, you're having a hard time. And it doesn't have to be bigger or lesser than anyone else's hard time. It's just, we all have our turn. And that is something that I've definitely struggled with, and that I feel like it's, you know, interesting, because if someone that I cared about or someone in the community needed help with something, like, no doubt I'd throw down if I'm able to and have the ability to. And there's no question I would. So why have I spent so many times when I could really actually use some help being like, oh God, I know I could never like ask for this, or I don't want to burden anyone, or I don't want to trouble anyone. And so just starting to like shift that and bring in a little bit more like radical love because it feels so good to receive help when you really need it. And then it just furthers the train, then it's like, okay, you know, then you can give help when someone else needs it, and it just becomes a little bit more normal.
Yeah, and also I find too, sometimes when other people ask for help, and if I'm in a good place myself, it's a nice time for me to take stock of the luck and blessings that I have in that moment too. And that makes us all, you know, when you have that moment of gratitude, it's also helpful for your own sense of resilience, really. Or kind of, sometimes I'll do a self-assessment like, wow, you know, I can be feeling like a loser one minute, and then go, well, considering the situation, actually you kind of rock that you made it through all that, you know. And kind of that sort of really I don't want to use the word comparing your contextualizing.
Sure.
It's context is really helpful sometimes, mm-hmm. right? When mm-hmm. you're feeling, whether you're feeling good or bad, it's a tool for sort of connecting to other people.
It just reminded me there was something that happened this summer that, and I have never done this before, but I was so glad that I did. There was kind of a spontaneous like tragedy, for lack of a better word, in my personal circle of friends. And, you know, so there were a couple, you know, days of an acute situation where I was just back and forth and like dealing with a crisis. And it wasn't mine, but it was very closely connected. And so there was all this, you know, kind of a lot of stuff to handle and a lot of scariness and weathering the storm, as I've been saying. But after a couple of days, I remember, you know, kind of going home and waking up in the morning and my head was pounding and I knew I couldn't return back to the crisis that day because I wasn't well. I needed like rest, but I felt like my nervous system had been on such overdrive that I felt like my nervous system was almost like bounding up against my skin and I wanted someone to like hold me or like a heavy blanket to weigh on me. And it was such like a profound feeling of need in that moment that I've kind of never really felt before. And a friend randomly like just texted me and was like, "Hey, how's it going? Like, don't worry about responding if you can't, but I'm just checking in and seeing how everyone's doing. Is there anything that you could use?" And I literally said to her, like, "Will you come hold me?" And I was like, "I can't believe I just said that. I can't believe I just said that. Like, can I ask for that? I just asked for that. Oh my God." You know, I was so like, felt so vulnerable. And she was like, "Great, be there in 10 minutes. And she came over and like brought me some chocolate and just like sat next to me and like hugged me and like put her arm around me. And literally everything felt better. And that was a huge moment. It's like this tiny, simple thing that I never, I don't know. I just like, it just was a huge moment for me. And I kind of feel like ever since that moment, like I feel less afraid for asking for real things that I need. And especially like in the kind of work that me and you do, we are offering a lot in terms of like physical care for folks, and we hold emotional space for a lot of folks, and that's our work and that's our passion and we're good at it, or we at least do the best we can with it. And navigating the boundary of how much we can give and then how much we need back has always been kind of challenging for me, and so I'm less afraid to ask for it now.
Awesome. That's great. I love that story. And yeah, again, to return to the don't wait for catastrophe,
right,
to take advantage of these kinds of self and community care practices. How about more affection? Mm. And I think I posted on Facebook actually a while back, you know, how radical it is to, I mean, I don't know, in the way I was brought up, at least in my experience in almost 50 years of being on the planet, mm. has been that folks in the United States don't often say, "I love you," mm. to people. Maybe their main romantic partner, mm. and maybe their kids, but like casual friendships. It's something that some of my friends and I have always said to each other,
sure.
but it, some other people have even overheard me on the phone, like, "Who are you talking to?"
Right.
And I'm like, "Hey, yeah, you can say that." Mm-hmm. And, you know, whether that's verbal expression or holding someone's hand, physical expression, mm-hmm. like that's a super simple thing to start doing. And mm-hmm. it feels good mm-hmm. to give as well as receive.
Totally.
Even when there's not an overwhelming feeling of need or drama, it's like, and it's also one of those things, I think, where the more frequently you do it, it's contagious in a good mm-hmm. way. It makes other people feel more comfortable, maybe. Gives them permission to and mirror it.
Right. Absolutely.
I think it's an awesome thing.
Yeah, sure. Love you.
Love you, too. I love doing this show with you, too. It's really...
I love WGXE.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. 7 years in.
Yes.
Right? Is that true? 2017?
I think so.
2010 started?
Just about, yeah.
Yeah. Well, so what do we think about... do you have any thoughts? I mean, I guess we're running-ish out of time, but just thinking about what you're saying, like, you know, not waiting for a disaster to happen, and then thinking about Rob talking about, you know, his thoughts and perspective on being a not only a community member, but becoming part of town politics, essentially. Like, mm-hmm. is there anything on your mind in terms of, like, Hudson specific, like, any infrastructure or ideas around, like, how we could prepare or create different systems, or I guess I'm not being articulate in my question, but you know, if
I grok what you're saying. And first I want to say too, another thing I just remember that I've been doing in my life, maybe the last 5 years or so, is having conversations with both friends and family of origin members, kind of like, hey, so if you got sick, and maybe even if you died, how would you like me to, you know,
handle
things? And, you know, a good friend of mine, we're going to do healthcare proxy with each other that each of us can make the decision. Like, say if I am unconscious and in a coma and it doesn't look like I'm going to recover, she has the, you know, she'll be like, yeah, do not resuscitate.
Right.
All that sort of stuff. I've talked to my parents about their plans for their, you know, their elder years and any wishes they have about things, like, especially if I need to make some decisions on their behalf. Getting clear about all those things has been a really interesting process. And then it also, of course, sets me on my own process of preparing myself for what I would want in the event of X, Y, or Z.
Yeah.
So maybe taking that out to the community too. Like, if people are starting to think about what their wishes are for the worst possible case scenario, how could the community respond? You know, I think it's interesting. We have a senior center, I think,
the
right?
Library.
Yeah. And it would be great if we had other similar kinds of, you know, it's great to identify under common ground, right? So why wait until we're elders or seniors? We could, there's a youth center too, but, you know, in terms of sort of finding other folks that you identify with in some way as having similar needs, and just starting to talk about, hey, how could it be better? I think that's, again, getting back to basics, you know.
Right.
I think stuff like that is really important, just to start having conversations, and rather than just assuming, oh, this is the model that we have, let's go with it. You know, can we create new groups and networks?
Right. Yeah, it'll be interesting too to see what's happening or what will happen going forward now that Hudson got all this money for economic development. And I know that there's like a panel now of folks that are going to be like overseeing the decisions of where that $10 million gets allocated. And, you know, Rob was saying, like, you know, Hudson Tourism and economic development, it's, you know, is and has been and is super steadily increasing, like a big part of our community here. But then if hits the fan, you know, and things all get wiped out in a second, God forbid, you know, gosh forbid, how can we think of development not just as like developing a tourist economy, but developing the continual needs of a thriving community of all folks included, not just the folks that come here on the weekend. And I understand that, you know, all parts of that are important, but I just have that a lot on my mind of it being great to see that money get spent in a diverse way, because there's so many infrastructure needs here.
I would also give a shout out too to Old Fashioned anarchist autonomist organizing, which which kind of accepts that the state, capital S state, the government and sort of all the institutions maybe don't always have or have inbuilt oppressions. So we could, it's totally valid to, you know, fight and dismantle things that the state or the government has created or try to work within the system, right? Yeah. Or you can also, you don't have to wait to organize, you know, you can also organize mutual aid societies and collaborative and collective ways of forming support systems. And, you know, the great Buckminster Fuller is often quoted as saying, you know, you can put your energy into fighting something, or you can build an alternative that's so superior it renders that thing obsolete, right? So there's that too.
Yeah, that's a good end note here.
Awesome.
Dang. Take that with us.
Love you.
Well, we'll see everyone next time, the fourth Monday of the month, Roots Runners Rhizomes from 2 to 3 p.m. So that'll be Monday, November 27th. Again, 2 to 3 p.m. And give us a shout on our Facebook page if you have any questions, comments, or ideas for shows, or want to come on and talk about dismantling capitalism and the patriarchy anytime.
Be well.
Bye.